When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When I heard Ewan McCall singing, I realised that there's more to folk music than old songs. We can have new songs as well. And McCall was writing about things that were happening all around him, you know. He was writing Dirty Old Town, and he was writing those kind of songs, Go Move Shift, about the travellers, and the Shoals of Herne, about the fishermen. And then the style of Woody Guthrie, you know, like... Say there, did you hear the news? Sacco worked at trimming shoes. Vanzetti was a travelling man. Pushed his cart around with his hand. Two good men's a long time gone.
Welcome to Free State, everybody. This is part two of The Life and Turbulent Times of Christy Moore. In this episode, we talked to Christy about the death of his own father when he was 11 and how he recalls it so vividly and with such accuracy even all these years later. It's a conversation about what grief does to you, and so obviously we talk about Stardust and the connection Christy had with the families and that extraordinary time when Christy found himself in court for contempt of court because of his song, They Never Came Home. But you may have also noticed at the start of episode one, Christy made a reference to having done some research into Joe. And we start this episode with Christy asking the questions.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
I heard a story about you getting a terrible battering at the Wailing Wall in Israel. Is that true?
That's a great story. You know that one. So, you know, the elderly, this is at when I was in St. Pat's Armagh.
Yeah, with the basketball team. So that's true. Well, there's another story as well I want to ask about.
Oh, the school teacher hit me. We were finished school.
He bit the head off you.
Well, it only required one punch. He was a big, strong fella and I didn't see it.
And there's another story. You came into my hometown in Newbridge a long time ago with a basketball team and you gave such abuse to the female referee.
That's not true.
That woman, she went and she joined the Brigidine Nuns. She never blew. Is that not true?
No, but I do remember scoring 2-3 in Newbridge one day.
It was a basketball team.
This is basketball.
No, I never played basketball in Newbridge.
Are you sure?
No, and I would never abuse a female referee.
Did you play basketball?
I played basketball, yeah.
And you went to Israel with a basketball team?
Yeah, we went to Israel. We were the Irish champions.
And the final was played in Newbridge?
No, in Israel.
No, the final for you to go to Israel was played in Newbridge.
No, I'll
have to go back to my source on this one, Joe. Carry on.
No, I would have been very well behaved in the back. See, basketball was a very disciplined sport. I was very well behaved, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't complain relentlessly the way I do now.
I met a fella actually in the waterfront.
I thought you were talking about the great Wailing Wall story about the elderly Jew. Have you ever been to the Wailing Wall?
No.
So you go to the Wailing Wall, and all the pilgrims, they pray, and they put their forehead against the wall, and they pray, and some of them ululate, you know, and so boiling hot day, the great Barry Cryer, the elderly Jewish comedian from London, he went out to the Wailing Wall, because he'd never been there, he was an old man at that stage, and he said there was a very old man in front of him, you queue up in lines, and then one person goes, and then you kneel and put your head against the wall and then you pray. It's called the Wailing Wall because people ululate. Or you can do it. So Barry Cryer was there. It was a very hot day. It's that white heat. And the elderly man was praying and praying and praying and praying, and eventually Cryer was about to go, and the elderly Jewish man got up. He says, "I'm terribly sorry, my young friend." He said, "I'm a very old man," he said, "and I come here every day." And Barry Cryer said to him, "You just for want of something to say," he says, "well, do you come here often?" He says, "Every day," he says, "I come for 30 years," he says, "and every day I pray for the same thing, peace between the Palestinian and the Jew. I might as well bang my head off the fucking wall."
Oh, Jesus.
I did get punched. Only me. I got punched at the wheel and wall by the PE teacher.
Did you? Why did he punch you?
We were haggling with the man over a kettle.
It's a good start.
Yeah, and he said eventually we were haggling with him and we lost track of time. The rest of the party had gone on. Me and this boy, Mick Muldoon from Ballyronan. Muldoon was tremendous fun and he had a very serious expression on his face. And the guy had started off at 5,000 shekels and he came down to 2,000 shekels. He says, "My friend, this magnificent kettle," he says, "you bring it home to Ireland." He says, "2,000 shekels. I not sell it to anyone to 2,000 shekels. And Muldoon goes, he goes, he said, I give you, after about 10 minutes of a bit of tea, you know, I give you one shekel." The guy lost the temper and he hit him with the kettle. And we were stumbling out of the tent down towards where everybody was. And the PE teacher, who, it was the last straw, he says, "Brawly, typical you," and boom.
Whoa.
In those days they did that.
Yeah.
And I got hit by the Dean of Discipline once in Armagh. He was a very serious big man, Father Fergus Kelly.
He was a huge big Dublin man. He talked like that. He was about 6'3",
toes inward. Very menacing big guy. He was the Dean of Discipline in the boarding school. And he was very rabidly anti-drink. A bit like you two. Anyway, he says, he made us take a pledge. We were only about 15 or 14, 15. And we had to take a pledge and we got diluted orange. And we had to sign a wee pledge to say we would never, ever drink, you see. And some of the boys for the crack, you know, tore it up and put them in the bin. And I got called out of study at about, say, I get two periods of study at night, and I got called out, "Father Kelly, what's this?" I was like, "What?" So I arrived up, knocked at the door, and he was a huge big man, you know, the big old style study, you know, and he opened it up and he could... "Child," he felt, "what have you done, child, what have you done?" And he had sellotaped it together. I said, "Oh, fuck, it was my stage today." And he just, bang, hit me in the nose, and my nose just like that. And I was on the ground, I remember being on the ground, with my hands on the ground, and the blood spilling down everywhere, and he threw a towel down on me, said, "Child, look what you made me do, look what you made me do." And I came out of the study anyway. And we were well used to physical force, because that's how the regime operated.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, you counted yourself lucky if you weren't being sexually abused. So I came out anyway, and the boys were standing around the corner, and they cheered when they saw the blood running out of my face. I was like, "Fucking brilliant," you know. Anyway, the postscript to the story, years and years and years later, I saw a picture in the paper of Father Fergus Kelly, who'd just been made the Vincentians worldwide head of child protection.
No. The right man for the job.
if a child needed punched.
Oh, yeah, he'd fucking do it.
By fuck, there'd be no trouble there whatsoever, Christy.
Yeah. But I was in boarding school myself for 3 years. And I was never aware of any kind of sexual activity going on at all. But subsequently, it turned out that there was, you know.
Exactly the same.
It was many, many years later before we heard about it, you know. Yeah.
See, we had no way of knowing. And, you know, the clergy at that stage was idolised. They were in a perfect position if someone wanted to. I mean, and I've spoken to some of the priests who were there in my time. And I genuinely believe that they had no idea that this particular priest was doing it.
I believe that. Yeah.
You know, he had a games room. The kids were going in and playing drafts and chess. Now, I'd have been big. I was sort of 5'9", 5'10", when I was second, third year.
Yeah.
But I know subsequently people who I know very well were horrendously sexually abused, you know, raped and...
Well, I was at a reunion a few years ago, and a man, he's gone since, he was the only surviving priest from my time there. He stood up and very emotionally apologised, and he said, "Lads, I had no idea that was going on. Yeah. And I'm so, so sorry that it happened and went on." Yeah. But he said, "We didn't know what was going on," and I believe him.
Well, it could be done secretly, you see. Yeah. He would invite the boys over to his quarters there at night on all sorts of pretexts to help them with projects, all of that sort of thing. And then once the child starts to become groomed at a young age, particularly then, because there was no one to talk to, I mean, what were you going to say?
Well, you were a good bit younger. Did you experience any of that in yours?
No. No, but there were priests in my school who subsequently were revealed.
Okay.
But by the time I was, I didn't experience it. And I also was very lucky in the sense, and you see it a lot with some of those awful stories where
pick kids who have no defence.
Yeah, and also, and they weren't believed by anybody. Whereas I was always in a position where I think, and I had one priest who made a couple of comments once, but I think I laughed at it. And I think my parents would always have believed me. And that gave you a great kind of strength. You know what I mean? Whereas some people were so, as you said, so in awe of the church.
Yeah.
And so deferential to the church that if it was their child's word versus the church's word,
it was just too monumental a thing to believe. It was easier not to. And in any event, no one complained.
Yeah.
You know, and of course I see this through my work, is one of the tricks, one of the themes is to carefully blackmail and control the child.
Mm. Yeah.
So that eventually the child's reality is skewed. You know, and like in St. Pat's Armagh, afterwards, because of my work, I was contacted by some of the boys. And, I mean, it was such a shock to me to hear about some of the...
What they'd endured.
Yeah, what they'd endured. Yeah. And, you know, it has lifelong consequences.
Oh, yeah.
You're talking about guys who you would think are very well adjusted, the intelligentsia who've gone on to have very good careers, and yet this silent... You know, this agony, this terrible thing that's inside you.
Yeah. What stays on? A number of guys from my year took their own lives subsequently, you know. And, you know, we talk about that and you learn about what their struggles were like. And I'm sure it's tied into what they endured in their teenage years.
It's a bit like that. It's a bit like what he said to me, you know, because I always remembered that. Look what you've made me do, child.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was my fault. And I accepted that without question. Now, like, I was anarchic and mischievous and all those things and very independent-minded always, just naturally like that. You know, as my father used to say, an awkward bastard.
Yeah.
But that
I've never seen that idea at all. I've never seen you being an awkward bastard.
The sweet side.
But there was physical abuse in schools was just...
Oh, yeah.
It was just... That was the norm,
at least that was because everybody was getting that, so it wasn't really. I mean, I can remember sitting in the study, and there was this English man who was a teacher. He taught biology, Jeff Randall. And he would say, you know, if somebody was talking or something, pass over a note, you know, the juniors, like we running wee scoots, and then he would say, "Are you going to do something about that, or am I going to have to do it myself?" to one of the seniors, who would then probably come over and clash you across the ear.
Hmm.
You know? I mean, and that's... It was...
you're reminding me of...
It was a full madhouse. Like, the first week I was in St. Pat's Armagh, first week, me and this boy, Tommy McChrystal from Berra. And Tommy was a wee tiny fella, you know, very feel wee lad. Awful nice fella. And we were going up the corridor, you know, in this new world. And sort of gloomy lighting and, you know, old building, you know. And we were going up the corridor, and the next thing we just got grabbed by a group of seniors and dragged up and just fired into the senior common room onto the ground. And the TV was on, and they were smoking, they were spitting on us. And I got there, you see? And this guy says, "All right," he says,
this is what happens, he says, to the wee bastards that mess around with us. You can tell your friends about this, you're saying. They spread-eagled this guy who was the senior. They spread-eagled him and he was screaming. They had a dartboard. He was screaming. And they took the dart and just fired the dart into his leg, you know, sunk, and he screamed. Mm-hmm. Ah! And then another dart and he screamed and I just thought, oh, we're dead. Tommy started crying. I thought, oh, Jesus, we're dead. They're actually going. And then the third dart, he just sagged on the ground, lying there, squealing. He says, tell your friends what you've seen here today, you know. We went out and he had... And about 3 days later, we discovered this guy, John Toll, he had a wooden leg, like a proper wooden leg.
Yeah, so it's a sign over here.
This was their party piece. They would take juniors up and terrify them by firing darts into this guy's wooden leg. Then they would send you out to be like, oh, geez, the boy's going to have to go to the hospital.
I just noticed...
And it was a proper wooden leg.
In regaling that story there, you've done 5 different accents. Hmm. It's a... hidden talent.
What were you saying it reminded you of, Christy? We'll get back to...
There was a Father Hegarty.
Yeah.
And he was a nice man, but one of the things he used to say was, I killed a boy once. It was dreadful. There was blood everywhere. And in rugby, if there was a blonde in there, you'd bind.
But you, in your book, you said that Brother Michael's choir he ruled with Cain and Batten as well. Sing sweet.
Oh, yeah.
Sing sweet, you little fuckers, or I'll bait the bejesus out of you.
Well, I'm using my own language there to describe what it felt like right. When I was 12 or 13.
Yeah, yeah.
But I look back on those patrician brothers. Some of them were vicious, but I look back on them kind of fondly, to tell you the truth. It was a happy time in my life. I loved my time in national school and secondary school. I got a few right fucking hidings, but I loved it.
Yeah.
I have good memories of it. I feel very fortunate to have gotten the education I got from brothers and priests. And
you think about the North. Where else would we have been educated?
You know,
meaning the Vincentians who educated me.
Yeah.
I mean, my memories are overwhelmingly fond memories.
Yeah.
You know, they were very liberal and very musical. And
I met Father Manley in Perth in Australia, Father Tighe Manley, and he taught me Irish in Newbridge, and he nearly knocked me out with a box one day in class because I was fucking really messing. But I met up with him afterwards in Perth, and the two of us got gloriously drunk and with a great night.
Right.
And just a lovely time. He'd be an uncle of Liam O'Manley's now.
Okay.
Tighe Manley, a famous Dominican priest. He ended up in Peru, I think, for maybe certain behaviours. They sent him to Peru.
Right.
Don't ask me what the behaviours were.
We can't mention those behaviours.
He was a good dancer.
Drinking with Christy Moore.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You said you said that, you know, when your son was 11, it made you realise, look differently upon yourself at the age of 11 when your father died.
That was just an interesting kind of revelation to me. I remember where I was, and Porrick was sitting in the back, and he just turned 11, and I saw him in the rear view mirror in the back seat, and it just dawned on me, that's the age I was when Daddy died. And it just made me realise the impact that might have had on me in a different kind of a way.
Because,
I was 11.
And you saw how young he was.
And I'd never seen it that way before, you know, how it might have impacted on me.
Because you were always, because I suppose from that moment you had to think of yourself as an adult. Like, whether even though you weren't, like, you were told you were the man of the house.
What I've come to realise, Dion, is that there were six of us at home with Mammy. And I was 11, I was the eldest. Barry was only 6 months.
Yeah, yeah.
But his death impacted on each and every one of us in completely different ways.
Yeah.
My sister Anne wrote to me just there last week explaining to me her day when she heard that Daddy died. And it was completely different than mine.
Really?
So we all had completely different, you know, and we're still carrying it to this day. Even Barry, Luca Bloom, who never met Daddy, he wrote a song called The Man Is Alive, The Man Is Alive in Me. You know, so we're all deeply affected by it, you know, in different ways. We still are. Like, he died in 1956. And, but, you know, that's life.
But I know many of the conversations we had have been about fathers and sons and that. And you had a lovely song one day you sang to me.
Really?
Yeah, about fathers and sons, which... do you remember that?
I don't, no.
I'm trying to remember it. It wasn't one of your songs. It was,
okay.
Yeah.
But Fathers and Sons.
Yeah.
God, you have me there now.
I know. I should have. I thought of it today and I was going to text you to see if you'd remember.
Well, the next time we're walking the pier, if you remember, I'll sing it to you.
Yeah, I do. I do. But it's amazing that it's still with you. It's amazing your sister is writing that letter, you know, and she's still going through those days.
Yeah, and I'd never thought of, I kind of assumed everybody else's day would have been the same as mine.
I know.
You know, but mine was it's like it happened yesterday.
It's extraordinary, you know, remember that.
You know, it really is.
Called out of school.
I remember Father McNally came into the class. There's about 50 of us in the class. Brother Brendan is his class, fifth class in National School. And Father McNally came into the class, and for some reason I got this weird feeling. He called Brother Brendan out, and then Brother Brendan came out and called me out. And Father McNally said, I think your mammy wants to see you. Would you go home? Your mammy wants to see you. That's all he said. And I got up on the bike and I cycled up the town. And when I got home, there was black crepe on the door. And I went in and all the neighbours were there. And so that's the way it was for me. Anne's thing was completely different. You know, her day was completely different. But anyway,
what happened to your dad?
He didn't have an ingrown toenail removed and died under the anaesthetic.
Jesus Christ.
So, no. It was the kind of thing, if it happened nowadays, there'd be murder over. But
sounds like the first two lines of one of your funny songs.
You know.
Jesus, it's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah.
An ingrown toenail.
Ingrown toenail.
Oh, fuck.
It was called the Drogheda Memorial Hospital. You were talking about the Coral there earlier on. It's now a hospice. But it was the Drogheda Memorial Hospital, but locally it was known as the Jockey, because when the jockeys would fall off the horses, they'd be taken over to the hospital. So it was called the Jockey Hospital. So that's where Daddy died, the 8th of October 1956.
Unbelievable.
It was a Monday.
It's a funny thing that I still find it extraordinary that you remember it so vividly. I mean, I know you're very close to the Bloody Sunday families, and I know that the Stardust families revere you, and I'm in the Stardust Inquest, as you know, for 10 of the families. And when people are treated with contempt, treated with disrespect, the way they were, you know, like the Bloody Sunday victims, like the Hillsborough victims, then it's as though time has stopped. You saw it with the Bloody Sunday families, with the Stardust families, just what you've said.
Yeah.
Every one of them, because we've got to know them so well, as you know. We were so close to them, and it's as much therapeutic as it is legal. They talk about their loved ones like it's over 40 years ago now, as though it was yesterday.
Yeah.
Genuinely, as though
I know
this was right in front of them, and every detail.
Time stopped then, and it just...
It's an extraordinary thing about human beings, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Why is that?
some coping mechanism. I don't know. The trauma of it just maybe it's like creates a photograph in your memory that just stays. Or I don't know.
And the funny thing is now, since they're being treated with great respect and properly represented, and their voices being heard.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's happening.
That you can see
the relaxing,
the visible release, and they're all the time they're talking about being able to sleep better.
Yeah.
Being able to enjoy their families better, being able to socialise better. There's a sense of goodness that has descended over everything.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I say they just revere Christy Dionne, but I remember at the commemorative day where they unveiled the new wall at the Stardust.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful new wall with all the 48... deceased, frozen in time, forever young, looking so beautiful and smiling, and they were all so young.
Yeah,
most of them were under 18.
Yeah, yeah.
You were not well. Do you remember?
I do. Yeah.
But you made a video. You sang and you sent up the video, and you could have heard a pin drop. Mm. All the firemen were there because they've shown tremendous solidarity. Yeah. The top brass was there.
Yeah.
All the fire trucks were there. They sounded the sirens, and then they played you on the big screen. Yeah. And it's funny how you've ended up all your life on the right side.
The memory I have of a really powerful memory for me is when the court case happened, and we're in either the High Court or the Supreme Court, I can't remember, over the song, and I was kind of feeling a bit paranoid that the song was getting all this publicity, and what are these families going to think, what fucking song? But I turned around and they're all there. They all came to the court that day to support me.
Yeah, you were sued for the song.
For contempt.
Contempt, yeah.
Because there was still
a particular line in the song.
The album was released, just for people who don't know, the album was released.
Yeah.
And They Never Came Home was on the album.
And it was banned and it had to be withdrawn. And I recorded another song called Another Song Is Born.
Yeah.
And the album was re-released. But that was my memory of that particular case.
But it was it exemplified how they were treated, that song was banned because of that line. And now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the accepted truth.
The offending line was all just because the fire exits were chained.
We've heard nothing else.
Yeah.
We've heard nothing else.
Yeah.
The doors are locked. Trying to kick them open.
But it must have been it was an extraordinary time to end up the person in court.
Oh, yeah.
Concerning Stardust was you about a song.
Reverse of a song,
But it was another example of, I think, the establishment versus Christy Moore, just like the H-Block album.
And the judge was very antagonistic towards me that day.
You see, there would have been that, I want to be careful of what I'm saying, which I never am, but not for reasons associated with me. But I think that, you had a very strong and corrupt political establishment then. And was that careful enough, Dion? A very strong...
Joe's now asking me to be
very,
the
a very
lawyer.
Strong and, a very strong and corrupt political establishment that sort of, the feeling always was that they had closed ranks and that the families were neither here nor there. They were North Dubs living in poor areas with no clout. So, fuck them.
Yeah.
And again, just like the way you stood in solidarity with us through thick and thin, that's exactly, I think, what you've done with the Stardust families. And to have someone like you, I don't know if you know this, but one of the things in an inquest, and this is all public information, is that, and particularly in this one, the families or a loved one, they choose a loved one or choose a family member to read a memorial about the deceased person, the son, the daughter, the mother, the father. And for one of the victims, the family asked Christy to read the pen portrait.
Yeah.
And it was immensely powerful, immensely moving. Mm. I remember you arriving in that morning.
Yeah.
And what are your memories of the fire itself and when you first heard of it?
I can remember exactly. I was playing in Moving Hearts, and we were doing a concert in Thomastown in County Kilkenny in the town hall. when we heard about the news of what was happening, and we stayed on. We were to do two nights, and we didn't know should we pull the second gig or whatever. We did the second gig and sent the money up to the so that's what, I was in Thomastown in County Kilkenny when the story broke.
And did the you mentioned the family's been there for the High Court case? Did that then create? Was that when that bond was created with them? Do you think then? And that's.
Oh, no, I think the actual the doing of the song was when the bond was created.
And was nobody else was it being ignored then? Was it being like was it something that you were aware of because of your own interest, or was it something that was kind of part of
just the story? Yeah. The story of it. It was. I was very influenced by the songwriting of Woody Guthrie. And Woody Guthrie wrote about things as they happened in a very raw kind of way. He didn't seek to be poetic. He just described the things that he heard about it or the things that he saw and tried to present it almost in a journalistic way. And sometimes it actually ended up being poetic, you know, because of the rawness of his language. And my limited songwriting would have been very influenced by Woody Guthrie and by Ewan McCall. Hearing Ewan McCall, when I heard Ewan McCall singing, I realised that there's more to folk music than old songs. We can have new songs as well. And McCall was writing about things that were happening all around him, you know. He was writing Dirty Old Town, and he was writing those kind of songs, Go Move Shift, about the travellers, and the Shoals of Herne, about the fishermen. And then the style of Woody Guthrie, you know, like, say there, did you hear the news? Sacco worked at Trimmin's Shoes. Vanzetti was a travelling man, pushed his cart around with his hand. Two good men's a long time gone. Sacco and Vanzetti were two Italians that were framed on a murder charge and executed because they were involved in the communist movement and the workers. And 50 years later, they were pardoned. 50 years after they fucking hung them, they gave them a pardon. But Guthrie wrote that song, you know. I'll tell you if you ask me about the payroll robbery. Two clerks were shot in the shoe factory down on the streets of Old Braintree. I'll tell you the prosecutor's names, Catman, Adams, Williams, Kane. Them and the judge were the best of friends, did more tricks than circus clowns. The judge, he told his friends around, he'd put them rebels down. Communist Bastards was the name the judge you gave these two fine men. Two good men's a long time gone. So those kind of songs, you know, saw the thing in me that, geez, maybe I could write a song.
Yeah.
You know?
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.